Now we're going to hear from Zoe Batarse. Zoe's husband, Andre, is with us this evening. Andre, hold your hand up. Welcome. Thank you for being here. Zoe was born in West Jerusalem and lived in the Old City of Jerusalem after 1948. She is Christian, whose parents were Greek and Palestinian. After marrying a Palestinian Arab, her husband's work took them to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Evacuated from the Congo due to political unrest, they moved here to California. Zoe is retired. They live in Rancho Bernardo, and she has worked for the United Nations Relief Agency and the United States Agency for International Development. Zoe Batarse.
Awareness, hope, and reconciliation is tonight's panel. Though I am not a public speaker, my kind of story, you will not hear it from the US media. The year was 1948. My parents have just moved to their brand new house with their two babies, my sister and myself, in an area called the Greek Colony in West Jerusalem. That year, while they were busy furnishing their beautiful new house, fighting broke out between the Jews and Palestinians. Due to the continuous bombardment for the city, which became unbearable for the family, especially after the Deir Yassin massacre of Palestinians by Israeli forces, they packed two small suitcases with some baby clothes and left their beautiful new house, furnishings unpacked yet, for the old city of Jerusalem to spend some days with some friends until the fighting stops. But ironically, they were never allowed by the Israelis to return. Thus, we became the refugees of 1948. They had their house, they lost their house and their businesses, and had to start their lives with two babies all over again. They lived for a while in one room, hoping that soon they will be able to go back to their house. That hope became a wish. Later on, the West Bank and East Jerusalem became part of Jordan. Its Palestinian population became Jordanian citizens holding Jordanian passports. Gaza was administered by Egypt until 1967. Note that the land of Palestine was inhabited by Palestinians and other nationalities from all over the world. A land, so it is a myth that it was a land without people, for a people without a land, as was claimed by the Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir. I grew up in the old city of Jerusalem, only 1 mile away from my beautiful house. After the 1967 war, my parents went to look for their house. The Jewish family living there refused to allow them to come near, as they were afraid that they might claim back their house. As a result of the 1967 war, Israel occupied the rest of Palestine, which is East Jerusalem, the West Bank of the Jordan River and Gaza, and handed the Palestinian population of the now called occupied territories Israeli identity cards. Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem hold the status of permanent residents, and their Israeli card constitutes the permanent residency permit that grants them the right to live in their homes, which is the same status granted to foreign citizens living in the country. Because Israel treats Palestinians like immigrants, whose status and rights are dependent on political considerations and the beneficence of Israel, in spite of the fact that they were born and lived all their lives in Jerusalem. Viewing East Jerusalem residents as foreigners who entered Israel is perplexing and particularly outrageous, since it was Israel that entered East Jerusalem in 1967, and under international law, Jerusalem is considered occupied territory. Its status is the same as the rest of the West Bank, and Israel had no right to unilaterally annex the area. I got married in 1972, and in 1973, I had to travel with my husband to the Congo, Africa, where he got an offer to work. Work opportunities are very difficult there, and we decided to take the job because it would give us the opportunity to build a better future and helping the rest of the families that stayed behind. So we made this difficult decision to leave our families, friends, and country and expatriate for a better life. We obtained and traveled on a travel document. Every year we were traveling back to Jerusalem in order to renew our travel document and return to our work, always following the laws introduced for the population under occupation, trying to abide by the regulations to avoid losing our residency. This went on for several years, but with the passage of time, the Israeli authorities would make every effort to make it difficult to Palestinians to obtain travel documents. Families started leaving because they were not granted residences for a variety of new residency laws structured exclusively for the Palestinian population. The quiet deportation was in process. The intent is a direct continuation of Israel's policy in East Jerusalem since 1967, whose goal is to preserve a permanent majority of Jews in the city so that Israel's sovereignty cannot be challenged. Maintain a ratio of 27% Arabs to 62% Jewish population. As we speak, a number of residents of Silwan, a village of 134 acres, population almost 11,000, were handed expulsion letters to evacuate their houses to make place for building a new settlement. These families have no place else to go, creating more refugee camps on Palestinian land again. My question to you is, we as Americans, the nation of peace and justice, why we do not become more curious and question the actions of Israel and where our tax money go? In 2006, we visited Jerusalem in order to obtain our new travel document, a duty we were doing for 33 years, leave alone the expenses of these travels. At the border, when the Israeli official looked at our papers, she told us to wait and started making some phone calls. The result was to tell me that she is revoking our residency on the basis that we live abroad and have another nationality. It was so simple and easy for her to revoke my right of living in my own country with a simple explanation and move on to the next victim standing beside me. I was able to control my rage and asked her, "What right do you have more than myself, who was born and raised in Jerusalem? Build my own house, the rest of my family is still living there. You just arrived from Russia. You have no affiliation to this country and do not even speak Hebrew." Her answer was, "You are a resident and I am a citizen," which means a resident is an immigrant on temporary status, non-Jew, while to be a citizen, one should be a Jew. To make it more clear, my Jewish friend, Ethel Swede, who is an American Jew, born and lived all her life in America. She can pack her suitcases tonight and enter as a citizen of Israel with all the VIP treatment. Myself, born, raised, and own my house in Jerusalem, I can only visit my country on a tourist visa with a limited duration of time. This is discrimination and violates the principle of equality, which is the foundation of all international human rights law and the laws of war under the Geneva Convention. This is happening as I speak to hundreds of Palestinians living abroad. This is called silent ethnic cleansing. I'm telling you my story tonight so that this silent ethnic cleansing is silent no more. Thank you.
In late September 2005, I found myself in Ramallah, West Bank, Palestine, standing beside Yasser Arafat's grave, flanked by four Palestinian soldiers wearing khaki uniforms. Now, what was a nice Jewish woman from La Jolla doing in a place like that? 10 years before, in 1995, I was teaching US history, and I knew very little about the Arab-Israeli conflict. My interest was in American history. And although I was a voracious reader, I read historical novels, I read nonfiction, I didn't encounter many books about the Palestinians. In fact, when I would go to my neighborhood libraries, I never saw books on the Palestinians. The books I chose dealt with progressive causes. The themes were the struggle for civil rights, for human rights, by blacks, by Native Americans, women, immigrants, and workers. Because of my parents' background, Ukrainian Jews, whose siblings and family were murdered in the pogroms and in Hitler's Holocaust, I also was interested in books dealing with the Holocaust and with the Russians' resistance against the Nazi invaders. The books I read, the political activists I babysat for, my parents' stories of the injustices and the horrors that they experienced because of their religion, caused me to participate in civil rights groups as I was growing up in college and after I graduated from college. All of this shaped my political consciousness. It made me really ready for a notice that I read in the La Jolla Light announcing that a speaker, a Palestinian, would be speaking at a local Jewish synagogue. And my husband and I decided that we would attend. The speaker was Manal Suarjo, and she told the story of her family's expulsion from Palestine by the Zionists. My husband Ed and I found her story compelling. Most of the audience found it threatening and expressed open hostility to her, to what she was saying. Manal's story prompted us to learn more about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, about the Palestinians. So immediately after the lecture, we drove to Bookstar, and we purchased our first two books on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They were Avi Shalom's The Iron Wall and Norman Finkelstein's Myth and Reality of the Palestinians, Myth and Reality of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And these authors are representative of a new breed of Jewish historians who depend or who rely on documentation rather than the traditional cheerleading myths that we're used to reading. The evidence was available because in the early 1960s, Israel opened its archives about the 1948 era. A month later, we attended a picnic sponsored by the ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, invited there by a woman we had met at Manal's talk. We made new friends, Palestinian friends, and we heard their narratives, riveting narratives. Our friend Nasser described how his grandmother, Rula, was forced out of her home in Safa in 47. She was forced to leave because of the massacres that were going on all around her, and they fled to Ramallah, where they settled. And the British had pulled out, so the Israelis were there just terrorizing and killing everyone, and she was afraid that they might meet the same fate as the villagers at Deir Yassin. Her ancestors had lived in Safa for generations, and Rula kept an album with photos of her home, the olive trees, and she also kept a large wooden key, which all Palestinians have, to remind them of their homes. When she was 76 years old and Nasser was 7 or 8, Israel temporarily lifted their border restrictions. They opened the borders. And she said, you know, I want to see my home before I die. So the family packed into various cars and they drove to Safa. When they arrived, she said, I want to go in there myself. So they observed her climbing up the hill, and they could see her knocking at the door, and they could see a short, stocky woman answering and just waving her fist at Rula and pointing toward the road. Rula didn't say a word on her way home, but later, she said, the woman, a Jewish immigrant and her family, had been living in her home for 10 years. She refused to let her come into the house. But Rula said, when I looked into the living room, I could see the curtains that my mother and I had sewn hanging in the living room. She kept my curtains. Our Palestinian friends invited us to various social and political functions, and eventually to join one of the dialogue groups led by a Jewish and Palestinian facilitator. We looked forward to these monthly meetings, particularly to listen to the narratives by the Palestinian. However, several things troubled us about these meetings. Most of the Jewish members rationalized their crimes against the Palestinian people with the equivalency argument, holding that both sides had behaved badly, so we couldn't blame one or the other. It was equal. And we should just ignore that it was the Jews who dispossessed the Arabs of their homes and fields. Reluctant to discuss history, they would say, you have your history, we have our history, so let's look forward and not backwards. Of course, the Jewish dialoguers would never apply this argument to the Holocaust. They spoke favorably about Zionism and the two-state solution, rather than believing in one secular state with equal rights for all people. Most troubling was their opposition to Resolution 194, UN Resolution 194, and subsequent 130 resolutions giving Palestinians the right to return to their homes. They opposed this because if Palestinians were permitted to return to their home, eventually they would become a majority. And that would mean the end of an apartheid state with special rights for Jews. Jews could return to their homes in Germany after World War II, Bosnians to Bosnia, Africans to their land, but not the Palestinians. For most Palestinians, it was a negative experience. Because how could they consider that these Jews could be a just partner for peace when They denied the original sin, the sin of stealing Palestinian land. So, as predicted, the dialogue group dissolved. But I think it was still a good thing for most Jews because it was the first time that they probably heard a Palestinian narrative, and it gave them something to think about. Another problem with these dialogue groups was that they didn't believe in political action. All they wanted to do was talk. And when you think about it, what is the difference between a person who knows nothing about an injustice and a person who knows about the injustice and does nothing? And while they didn't believe in political action, of course, the pro-Zionist organizations were very politically active. My husband and I went with a newly formed a local peace group to visit a congressman, to ask him to help us to counteract AIPAC. This group was very conservative, actually, but they didn't like AIPAC. They thought AIPAC was bad for Jews. And when we talked with this congressman, he told us a story. He said, you know, one afternoon, I voted for a bill against what AIPAC thought was Israel's interests. And as I was walking down the Capitol steps on the way to catch my plane on the way to the airport, suddenly this guy appears before me, an AIPAC lobbyist, and he says, "We didn't like the way you voted." And he said, that year, he lost $250,000 in contributions for his campaign. So he asked us, if I help you, what are you going to do for me? What could we do for him? Could we raise $250,000? Because we realized that activism is a crucial role in any political struggle, my husband organized Alternate Focus, which is a weekly TV show now on Public Access TV and the Satellite Dish Network, presenting alternative views of Middle East issues. His two partners are a Christian Palestinian and a Lebanese Muslim. In 2004, our Palestinian friend, Ty Oda, who's in the audience here, knowing Ed was an educator with an interest in videography and classical music, proposed that we travel to Nazareth, Israel, to produce a documentary about his brother-in-law's program to promote classical music among students in Nazareth, because the Israeli government was not funding the arts. We were invited to stay with Ty's sister and brother-in-law in Nazareth and would have time to visit other areas, including the West Bank, Palestine. We've never met warmer and more hospitable people than the Palestinians that we encountered in Israel and in the West Bank. Ty's relatives are Israeli Palestinians. That means that the Palestinians who didn't flee, who stayed in their homes in 1948 during the war, were allowed to remain there, but they live as second-class citizens. Nazareth is a densely populated city. It's an Arab city with people living literally on top of one another. In the late 1950s, the state actually confiscated city land to build a Jewish city on the hilltops called Upper Nazareth or Nazareth Elite. A few wealthy Arabs are allowed to live there, but it's mainly for Jews. There are 50,000 residents, two-thirds of Nazareth's population, yet they control three times as much land. This city looks like a spacious Los Angeles suburb, while below, Arabs are crowded together, forced to build up sometimes three or four stories because it's extremely difficult for Israeli Palestinians to obtain building permits from the government. 90% of Israel's land is state-owned and reserved exclusively for Jews. Ironically, while the Israeli Knesset was passing discriminatory laws against their Palestinian citizens, the U.S. Jews were protesting discrimination against them in this country, in housing, quota systems, in the universities. And I couldn't have bought my La Jolla house in the 1950s because Jews were not allowed to live there. I support the Palestinians because I believe in equal rights and justice for all people. I oppose the state of Israel because, by definition, a Jewish state cannot deliver this to non-Jews. And I call on you, everyone here, to support the Palestinians through sanctions, through blockade, whatever it takes to have Israel join the civilized nations and treat their Palestinians equally. I think we have to remember what Ahlam said, that it's not just Israel that we have to target, that the Western colonial powers created Israel, maintained it. It was mainly France and England at the time. Today it's the United States for their economic and geopolitical reasons, and that they are, that really Israel is their cop on the beat during their dirty work. So when the Congress forbids money to be allocated to dictators or to countries like Nicaragua, or like South Africa, then we get our money to Israel, and Israel funds them. That's what happens. They are Coptic on the block there to keep order, to pursue our interests in the Middle East. I think that's about all that I want to say. To have a just peace, we have to press both Israel and the United States to abandon their predatory policies in the Middle East.